Hello and welcome into the Gotta Be Saints podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Gotta. Join me each week as I speak with future saints about being saints. Today's podcast is titled The Rise and Fall of Western Thought with Dan Leroy. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks, Brendan. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a joy to have you. So, as I said, we're here to talk about the rise and fall of Western thought. Dan has just recently released a book that shares that title. It's Why We Think What We Think, The Rise and Fall of Western Thought. To begin, Dan, can you just kind of introduce yourself?
I can. I'm a journalist by trade. I'm the author of several books. I'm a teacher, the director of the writing and publishing department at Lincoln Park Performing Arts Charter School, which is a public charter school right outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's a gift to get to talk to you. So I was intrigued by the title of your book. I think this is a conversation that probably here we're going to try to keep it to 30 minutes, but probably is able to be unpacked over many, many hours, I'm sure. And hopefully within our conversation, two things can come about. One, of course, that people pick up your book and are gravitating towards that. Secondarily, and maybe more importantly, or probably more importantly, you know, each conversation here at the Gotta Be Saints podcast is focused on that idea that as people here on this earth, we have been given this opportunity to be holy, to be saints. And so, of course, coming with that is this desire to pursue holiness and then accepting the graces of the moment. But I think philosophy, theology, these things are of great importance to our desires and our pathway to holiness. Now, of course, that does not mean that somebody has to be a theologian or a philosopher to be holy. But at the same time, there is great value in learning these things. So I'm excited for our conversation here today. I want to start by just asking you, what really inspired you to embark on this really sweeping exploration of Western thought? And then why do you believe now is a critical time to revisit these philosophical roots?
Well, as to the origins of the book, among the classes that I've taught at the high school level for a number of years is an introduction to philosophy course. And in the course of teaching this class, one of the things that has occurred to me repeatedly is there really is no great single volume introduction to philosophy. From my perspective, that seems like a crazy thing because there are so many books about philosophy out there. But I've found some that do one thing and some that do another, but none that did the thing that I was hoping they would do, which is not just introduce philosophy, but introduce it in the context of the way that it really has developed in the context of a story. And there are some kind of grab and go volumes, which are, they have their utility, let's say, as a textbook, but to really get people interested in it as a subject, I think you got to tell the story. And I think that's true in a lot of other fields as well. And in particular, there was no single volume about philosophy, an introduction to philosophy that took things from the Catholic perspective. There's a lot of great books about Catholic philosophy, but none, again, that did what I was hoping to do, which was put it all in one package. Many of the really good ones are multiple volume. And I thought for a beginner, you know, we're in a society where it's tougher and tougher to get people to read. And therefore, the more volumes you have, I think it becomes less and less likely that people are going to do it. So that's the origin of the book. As to why now, one of the reasons for that is, as I try to lay out in the introduction, philosophy for a lot of people is it's a dead issue. It's a silly thing to talk about. It's an even sillier thing to study. People believe that it is essentially irrelevant, even though we all have philosophies by which we live. As a study, it's thought to be something that is just a waste of time. Sadly, philosophy has done that to itself over the course of hundreds of years, especially over the last 100 or 150. But if we're going to solve the problems that, of which there are many, of which we talk about all the time, philosophy has kind of gotten a pass from people as an originator of some of those problems. One reason that we have trouble solving the problems is we don't know where a lot of them came from. And where a lot of them came from, unfortunately, is philosophy, or at least modern philosophy. Philosophy since the Reformation, at least. And it's really tough to solve a problem if you don't know where the problem originated. And so as to why now, we've got a lot of problems and we seem to not know the origin of these problems. And so the reason for writing the book was to kind of pinpoint some of these things, where they originated. And frankly, to not let philosophy off the hook. Philosophy is a great subject. It's one of my favorite subjects. It's also done a lot of damage. And it kind of got off, we've let it off the hook, if you will. I think philosophy shouldn't be let off the hook. So maybe that's the short version of why I wrote this book.
Yeah, well, I'm connecting with all the things you're saying. I think back to my college experience taking philosophy classes. That was a requirement where I went to school, just two or three, I think. But, you know, it was still something there. There was still some substance. But I also think back to I had a really good friend who studied philosophy in college, but did not go to a Catholic university. And you talk about the damages that it did. I think this person found a way to use his philosophy background to justify the actions that were very contrary to moral truths and contrary to natural law. But he was able to justify it because he could explain everything in his mind. And certainly was able to at least articulate his vantage point in a way that would make many people decide not to argue with said person because he at least sounded smarter than them. So I think this is very interesting and a necessary conversation. So I also like that it sounds like with your book, you're trying to make philosophy a little more, not only attractive, but understandable for the everyday person, which is it would be quite a feat in itself to do that. So I guess my next question for you, you know, in your book, you discuss a significant detour in philosophy that took place nearly 1,000 years ago. Can you elaborate on what this detour was and why it was so pivotal for Western society?
Well, the detour happens at the end of the scholastic period, the medieval period. And the movement, in short, is a movement away from what I think and what a lot of other people think is really a high point in Western thought. And that is the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. And for a guy who wrote as many words as he wrote and is as well known as he is, this is a guy who's been misrepresented more, I think, than perhaps any other philosopher in history. And that is saying something, because there, philosophy as a genre, one of the subsets of it is misrepresentation of people's views. But Aquinas in particular has been misrepresented in multiple ways. We'd have to do 10 podcasts just to go into all of those. But one of the biggest ways is that many people believe that Aquinas's views, the views that he outlined in his masterwork, the Summa, people believe that, well, science came along and contradicted all of that stuff that Aquinas and the other scholastics believed, and therefore they're irrelevant. And that is absolutely not the case. People abandoned the work of Aquinas and the other scholastics because, to go back to what you were just talking about with your friend, because it's very inconvenient, because that work doesn't allow people to do the things that they would like to do. So the story of modern philosophy is the story of how we move away from the work of the scholastics, which achieves this really great, some would say perfect, synthesis of reason and the evidence of the senses, the idea that we have a mind and we have a body and they work together, and they work together to interpret the evidence of the world. And we can trust that evidence because we can trust in God's creation. It's a very common sense philosophy. Many, many people who are not Catholics and who don't know anything about Aquinas follow this philosophy in their daily life, whether they realize it or not. But we took this detour, and the reason we took the detour is really the story of the second half of the book. And that story is the story of the liberation of man. And the only way that man could truly be liberated, in the sense of being able to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, to whomever he wants, without any consequences, the only way that we can do that is to abandon the work of Aquinas, which build on the work of the great classical philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and in particular, Aristotle. We have to throw all that out because it is getting in the way of the liberation of man. And that's a long story. That story spans, as you say, 700 or 800 years. It's a pretty tragic story. You can look around us today and see that the modern philosophers who tried to liberate man, hey, they were very successful. We got to give them that. Unfortunately, you look around us and you see the atomization, the alienation, the unhappiness at record levels in the face of affluence and prosperity that the ancients could never have dreamed of. Everybody knows that story. We're sadder, more depressed, more anxious than ever before. That is the work of the modern philosophers too. They have to take some responsibility for this. They liberated man. They were successful. And now we're living through the results of that liberation. So when I say philosophy needs to be held to account, the detour that it took away from this great common sense synthesis of the mind and the body, of reason and the senses, toward these completely convoluted ideas, many of which I'm sure your friend probably studied in those philosophy courses that he took. They don't make a lot of sense on paper, but they do make sense if you understand the motivation. And the motivation is to create a situation where man owes nothing to anybody, not to God, not to church, not to family, not to friends, community, nothing.
Yeah.
A completely free and liberated individual who is the most miserable individual in the history of mankind.
Yep. We see it every single day in our society here, and it is shocking how you and I, who are blessed to know the Lord, can look at this life, say, how can you not recognize that this is not what's going to bring you joy? And yet, so many people continue to go on that path. And one thing, this is more of a side note, but I think a big thing I notice is look at the way that someone looks year over year. And the more, I had a friend share a photo of her sister the other day, and this person did not look joyful, did not look happy, and had taken on a look that was very foreign to what she looked like 5 years ago. And I didn't even know this person, but I found myself, you know, looking at their social media to say, oh, and this person, in my opinion, and I think would be in the opinion of so many, was a beautiful woman, just, you know, very, just had joy on their face. And yet that joy seemed to have completely gone away. And I could only imagine what had led to this transformation. In knowing this person's, you know, way of vantage point of life, I wouldn't have to go very far to figure out what happened. You know, this same thing that you're describing took on a hold in this woman's life, and now she was liberated and yet had never been probably less happy. In your book, you also mentioned the big three philosophers and their views on attaining happiness. Could you briefly outline who they are and then their respective theories?
Yeah, the big three, we go back to classical Greece, which is where Western thought, like so many other things in the West, begin. That's Socrates, who was the teacher of Plato, who was then in turn the teacher of Aristotle. And while there are big differences between these three philosophers, who are still thought of as three of the greatest minds to ever have lived, one thing that all of them had in common, and that a lot of the early philosophers had in common, and it's a thing, as we were just talking about, that gets abandoned in the modern era, is the idea that man has a purpose. And what is that purpose of man? And all three of these guys, to greater or lesser extent, agreed that, and, you know, we are talking about three guys who were pre-Christian. So they're not talking about this in the Christian context. And yet it's very, very applicable to the Christian context. Man is a rational being. Man is the only rational being. He has the gift of rational thought. Because he has this gift, his purpose in life is to use that knowledge, to pursue knowledge not towards some end necessarily, but it's a good thing in itself. To pursue knowledge makes us virtuous. Now, the Christian philosophers would come along, Augustine, Aquinas, they would adapt that and they would say, you know, that we're using that rational capacity to gain knowledge. The knowledge we're trying to gain is the ultimate knowledge, the knowledge of our Creator, the knowledge of God. But the idea is the same, that we are designed for this purpose. We are designed to seek the truth. We're designed to seek knowledge. If we don't fulfill our purpose, we're going to be unhappy. There's nothing that is going to bring us happiness if we do not fulfill what the Greeks would have called telos, the purpose of life. So all three of these guys agreed, and many who followed them agreed, man does have a purpose. He has some meaning, and to gain this meaning, he has to seek the truth. These are things that go out the window with the modern philosophers. Knowledge takes on a completely different cast. Knowledge is now not something to be pursued because it is virtuous in and of itself. It's only good for stuff. It's good to predict and control nature. And that, of course, has given us many, many wonderful, we have to say, scientific discoveries, made life more comfortable and pleasant than, again, the ancients could ever have dreamed. But it hasn't brought us any more happiness by any measure. And I think we could say that in abandoning the idea that we do have a purpose beyond just creating more and better inventions, more and better stuff, it's why we're not happy. It really isn't that complicated an idea. The ancients were right. They had it right all along. And when we made that detour that we were just talking about, we made a detour toward inventions, toward stuff, toward longevity, toward inventions. These are all great things. But we didn't make a detour toward happiness. Those things are not it. And the only way to get back to this idea of how do we solve the fact that people are so unhappy, we have to acknowledge people have a purpose. We have to acknowledge what that purpose is, and we have to pursue that purpose. It's not exclusive necessarily to all these other things. It doesn't mean we're anti-science, anti-invention, but what has come along with science is the idea that there is no purpose. We're put here for what reason? We don't know. We have no idea. So let's make as many things as we can to make ourselves comfortable while we celebrate our purposelessness. And, you know, it shouldn't be that complicated. smart yeah. people ought to be able to figure this out, but clearly it's an idea that has eluded not just individual people, but whole generations of people.
Interested in learning more about your faith? I invite you to check out Good Catholic. They are a digital media brand focused on sharing and teaching about the faith. From podcasts to blogs to digital series, Good Catholic has it all. Use the code in the show notes to get 20% off your order at Good Catholic. Well, you're getting me to think too, back to the Old Testament. You look at Solomon, what does he ask for? He asks for wisdom. And that thought, that idea is laughable to some extent, thinking about somebody today, you know, thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great to have wisdom? In today's culture, wisdom isn't what provides happiness. It's power, it's money, you know, it's those things. It makes me also think of, there's a book that maybe you've read by St. Louis de Montfort called Love of Eternal Wisdom. And he talks about this, and he talks about the wisdom that is the foolish wisdom, which so many people have, which is gravitating towards appearance of being a noble and good person. But all you care about is exploiting what's been given to you to use for your own gains, which is seemingly what you're describing. And that was him writing back in the 1700s. You know, and we've progressed now 300 plus years, and we've only deepened that thought process. And now it is impacting so many people, all of us to some degree now in our society. All you have to do is think about even this medium, which I think a podcast is a good medium if used well. And yet, how many people listen to, myself included, listen to meaningless podcasts at times that probably do little to nothing for us? I was just listening to a golf podcast yesterday about golfers, and it entertains me. But, you know, the question could be asked, how does this help it, my journey towards holiness? Anyway, that's a side point. But I also want to, of course, now go at it from something you've mentioned multiple times, which is Christianity. You know, this is, of course, a central point, I'm sure, in your writings. You know, the intersection of ancient philosophy and then Christianity, you know, those old philosophers, they were before Christ, of course, but natural law had been written on their hearts. They had this desire to pursue knowledge, to know who and what their purpose was, as you mentioned. So how do you navigate those conflicts that might come up in those schools of thought? And then the points of convergence, of course, that are very real.
It's a great question. And the good news for us is that two of the smartest men who ever lived have really done a lot of the heavy lifting for us already, if we dig into what they wrote and what they said. And those are St. Augustine, who it said baptized Plato. He took Platonic thought and he was able to adapt it to Christianity. And then, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas does a more difficult thing, because by the time he comes along in the medieval period, a lot of the works of Aristotle have been rediscovered. They went out of circulation for centuries, and it was only in the Middle East that those works were preserved and philosophers were working with them. They don't get reintroduced into the Christian world until around about the time of Aquinas. So his job now is to synthesize not just Plato, but also Aristotle, who's a more difficult philosopher to synthesize with Christian thought. But that's what made Aquinas the genius that he was. So both of these guys really have written the map out for us. But the reason that their jobs were doable was, again, because while there are big, big differences, obviously, between, you know, the pagan classical philosophers and the Christians who followed them, one thing that was consistent, again, was this idea that knowledge is virtuous, that man has a purpose. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, they all agree on this very basic point. And that is a point, again, that has been abandoned by the modern philosophers. So what's great about both Augustine and in particular Aquinas is that they were able to produce this synthesis of classical thought and Christian thought, and they're able to do it in a way that doesn't, how would we say, paper over some of these differences. A good example of this is Aquinas. And one of the big problems that people had with Aristotle was that Aristotle seemed to suggest that the universe had always existed. And that was a big impediment to not just Christian thought, also Jewish thought, Muslim thought. This was a problem that all the big three monotheistic religions had with Aristotle, because he seemed to be downplaying or maybe denying the creation of the universe. Aquinas is a smart guy. He said, look, there's three things that we can only know by faith alone, and the creation of the universe is one of these things. He was such a practical philosopher that he said, look, there are just some things that it's not worth arguing about. So whether the universe has always existed, whether it was created, obviously Aquinas believed that it was created. He didn't think that that was a point that it was worth expending a lot of resources on. Instead, he focused his efforts on the stuff that was much more germane. And that would take us, at least in part, to his five ways. Two pages out of a massive, massive book, which are probably the two of the most famous pages of philosophy ever written. And in those five ways, just in those two pages, which he goes into in much greater detail later in the Summa, but in those five ways, he uses logic and he shows us that these ideas of Aristotle's, these ideas of the pagan philosophers, they're not incompatible with Christian belief. For example, his idea of the argument from motion, which is that everything changes motion in the universe, and that if everything is a combination, as Aristotle said, of the actual, what it actually is, and the potential, what it could be if it's changed, we have to trace that back to its root. And the root is a being that Aristotle, again, who was a pre-Christian philosopher, called the unmoved mover. And that is Aquinas' conception of the Christian God, but they're completely compatible ideas. So I guess the short, since I've gone on for quite a while in answering
this. No, you're good. You're good.
The short version of the answer to that question is, it's surprising that there's such compatibility between the classical philosophers and these Christian philosophers of the toward the end of the Roman Empire all the way up through the medieval period. That's not difficult. Where things get difficult is after that, in the modern era, when philosophy stops trying to solve problems and starts trying to create problems. This is where we see the stuff again. That's probably was in your friend's philosophy class, the person there who gets most of the blame probably is René Descartes and his reopening of the mind-body problem. He does a famous experiment where he says, look, I'm going to figure out what can I know for certain. I'm going to eliminate everything I can't know for certain. So he throws out the evidence of the senses. He acknowledges that he might be dreaming, as we've all done. We've had those dreams that are so realistic, we think we're awake, but we're not. And then
my dream last night, I was thinking about bourbon. It felt very real.
Well, then that's very sad when that dream turns out to be just a dream.
I thought I had some really good bourbon in my hand, and it turns out I didn't. Today's podcast is sponsored by The Catholic Company. The Catholic Company is a one-stop shop for all your Catholic needs, from rosaries to books to clothing. The Catholic Company has it all. Use the code in the show notes to get 20% off your order.
But Descartes goes all the way down in this pit. He even says, well, look, if everything's a dream, maybe I'm being deceived. Maybe there's a demon who's trying to trick me. So it's sort of the scenario of the Matrix, you know, where how do we know that any of this is real? How do we know we're not living in a simulation? And Descartes reaches that famous conclusion, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And he realizes, look, no matter what else, no matter whether I have a body or not, no matter whether a demon is trying to trick me, I know that I'm thinking. I am a thinking thing, and therefore that's the one thing I can hang my hat on, if I actually have a hat. So he proved his point. But what a lot of people forget is that that leaves him at the bottom of this philosophical pit with no way out, no knowledge of whether he has any physical presence or not, no way of knowing whether he's being deceived cruelly. The only way he gets out of the pit is by calling on God. And he uses that old ontological argument. He says, well, if I can think, and I can think of a perfect being, and that being doesn't exist, then he's not perfect. Therefore, that being has to exist, and that being has to be God. And therefore, if there is a God, then he wouldn't deceive me. He wouldn't make me think my life's a simulation. And step by step, he gets out of the pit. But he only gets out of the pit with God. Without God, we're down there at the bottom wondering if we're just a mind, a brain, a whatever, if everything is the Matrix. So there's a great example of a philosophy, modern philosophy, creating problems rather than solving. He didn't solve anything. God solved the problem that Descartes created. And unfortunately for Descartes, he could never manage to reconcile, even after that, how the mind and the body communicated with one another. And that has been a problem in philosophy ever since the 17th century. So we're working on several centuries worth of trying to figure out this basic thing that Aristotle, Plato, well, not so much maybe Plato, but Aristotle knew it, Aquinas knew it. It seems like a lot of backtracking for no particular purpose.
Yeah, well, I appreciate everything you've said, Dan. I don't want to take too much more of your time. I guess I just have one more question for you. Let's look at this. I know this is a question that you could probably expand on for a long time. So the short 2 to 3 minute version of how do you envision this restoration taking place in practical terms within philosophy?
The first thing that has to happen is that people have to know what philosophy is and what has gone before, because it's going to be difficult to solve the problem if we don't see where the problem came from, which is where I hope this book can help. The second way that this restoration could take place is we can look at the truly revolutionary development, the one truly revolutionary development over the last 150 years, and that's in Catholic philosophy. While everything else has slid down into the pit, the Catholic philosophers have actually, really beginning with Pope Leo XIII toward the end of the 19th century, the Catholic philosophers have managed to stake out defensible, coherent, exciting, in some cases, positions. How have they done it? They've done it by going back to the source material. Particularly, they've gone back to the work of St. Thomas Aquinas, and they have found what we were saying at the beginning. Hey, nobody actually disproved any of this stuff. They just abandoned it because it was inconvenient. Nobody ever invalidated. So if you look at the work of the contemporary philosophers, Gertrude Anscombe, the one living philosopher in the book, the Scottish thinker Alistair MacIntyre, these are people who went back to Aquinas. And in the case of MacIntyre, here's a guy who was a Marxist who tried every other system. He wrote a book called After Virtue, in which he realized, like, hey, maybe the ancients were onto something. In the course of doing this, that led him to Thomism, which led him to Catholicism. So here's an example of a brilliant man who was actually led all the way back by studying the philosophy, by learning the philosophy and knowing what had come before. It led him back to the place that I think we have to get back to, and that is to the Thomistic thought that never should have been abandoned 700-800 years ago in the first place.
I like it. I hope that this does happen, and I think in certain circles it is. So now it's getting these groups of people who are fighting for that to continue to expand that and get it within your schools, help young people learn these great things. So I want to give you a chance. Where can someone get your book?
They can get it from the publisher, Sophia Institute. They can get it through all the usual online outlets as well, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They can also get it through my website, which is Dan Leroy. That's LEROY.com. I'm in the process of updating it, but as soon as I get that done, if someone would like a signed copy, it'll be available through my website, and I'll be happy to sign it up however you want and send it wherever you would like.
Perfect. Well, I'll include that in the show notes so that people can purchase it. Dan, I got two quick questions for you. God willing, one day you're going to be a saint. What are you going to be the patron saint of?
Boy, oh boy. Well, there's already probably more than one patron saint of education. So I'll go for a much more specific kind of education. I'd like to be the patron saint of, how do I want to put it? I want to be the patron saint of, it's eluding me. I was just in class with some middle schoolers earlier today, and I was having, well, I wasn't thinking about being a saint. I have to admit, being with middle schoolers will probably move you much further away from sainthood. to best put it into words, which are clearly eluding me, I'll say it this way. I like to be the patron saint of marginalized young people. And marginalized not in the way we think of it in terms of like you're in this particular group or you identify this way. I don't mean that. I mean marginalized young people as in marginalized by parents who have let them down, by schools who've let them down, by society which has let them down. That's a lot of young people. I mean, actually, that's a hell of a job for a saint. That might be a pretty tall order. If I can't be the patron saint of marginalized young people, I'll settle for being the patron saint of drum machines. That's an easy. I feel like I got a lot less competition there.
I like it. All right, last question for you, real quick. God or not God willing, who's on your Mount Rushmore of saints?
Oh boy. Well, as we've been talking, I mean, two that have to go on there are certainly Augustine, Aquinas.
Yep.
They're on there. I have to put St. John Paul II on that Mount Rushmore because what a lot of people don't know about him is that he was not only a great saint and a great pope, he's also a great philosopher, and he doesn't get credit for the philosophical part of that. Now, the fourth one is tough. I might have to get back to you about that. The first three are easy. I'm going to have to do a little more thinking about who gets that final spot.
All right. Well, I expect a response from you at some point. So I want that fourth person. But thank you so much, Dan, for coming on. This has been a real joy getting to talk to you. You're always welcome. But thank you to everyone at home who listened to today's podcast. Hopefully you find yourself more inspired to pursue holiness today and always. God bless you and have a great day.
God bless. Thanks again.
Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe and check out goodcatholic.com for more details.